it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Chet Hartman Show, noon to 3 every weekday. Just one little change today. Chad's not here.
It's not a little change. That's a big change.
It's a big change. He's out doing I don't know what, probably enjoying this beautiful day. Dave, do you know what he's doing?
You know exactly what he's doing.
Has something to do with a little white ball. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Good for him. It's a beautiful, beautiful Minnesota fall day. We're glad you're here with us today on the Noon to 3 show, Chad Hartman Show. I'm Tim Pawlenty, former Minnesota governor, filling in for Chad today. And we're glad that we're going to talk about a number of things also. And I want to start, Dave, with just kindness, gestures of kindness in this world where there's so much polarization, so much people at each other, either politically or otherwise. You know, I was downtown today a little earlier, and there's a gentleman who works down here in a place I won't name, but every time I see him, and I see him a lot, happy to greet you, you know, doesn't necessarily agree with my politics, but is civil about how we discuss it. But he's just somebody that when he enters your life, it brightens the room or brightens the day, as opposed to somebody who takes a different approach. I want to shout out. He asked him how he wanted to be greeted on the radio, and he said, refer to me as Big D.
Big D.
But he's a day brightener. He's a day brightener, and in our world today, we need more day brighteners.
We could use more of those, absolutely. Is this somebody you've gotten to know personally now, or is just kind of a, you know, acquaintance you see once in a while? And
well, it's somebody who works nearby that I see him as I come and go, and I just over the years has observed he's a chronic day brightening optimist, and I just think, gosh, well, you know, that's in a small way every day he makes our lives better.
That's kind of fun. Those people that you may not see every day, you may not see every month, but you kind of have a feeling when you're in this area, there's a good chance. And I bet you showed up here and you looked forward to it.
I did.
You were hopeful that you could see Big D.
Big D. It's his own moniker. Yes. You know, I didn't
assign
it.
Okay.
But let's talk about some people who don't always brighten our day. And that's the group of people, the 535 of them that we've elected to the United States Congress. Oh, boy. So here we have a government shutdown. And one of the things I can do as a guest host and a former politician is bring some context and insight as to what's going on. And I'll try to do it even-handed in this situation. So our United States Congress hasn't balanced a budget in the modern history of the country, with the exception of a few years in the late 90s when Gingrich was Speaker and Clinton was President. So they don't even try to balance the budget anymore. They've given up on that. They run chronic deficits. But worse than that, they don't even do a regular budget anymore. They're supposed to have it done on a certain schedule. They always miss the deadline. So then they have to do something called a continuing resolution, a CR, to keep the government going for a while they get to the next full budget that they're going to pass, you know, through their regular process. But that requires, especially even though the Congress is majority Republican currently in the Senate, it requires some help from the Democrats because of the procedural rules. So the Democrats have said we would consider that continuing resolution until late November, 6 weeks or so, if you'll do a few things for us. And those few things include reinstating the recent decreases in subsidies for Obamacare for certain people and making some changes to the Medicare, quote unquote, cuts that were made as part of the Big Beautiful Bill. And those are significant changes, and that's in exchange for just a 6 weeks delay. It's not exchange for a bigger budget, just a 6 weeks delay. And the Republicans have said that's too much to ask for in the context of a 6 week delay. So here we are with a budget stalemate. And I want to ask you, Dave Harrigan, to pretend, and our WCCO listeners, pretend you're a senator and you're in this circumstance and somebody comes to you and says, you know, I need and want these Obamacare subsidies at an elevated level. They were supposed to be temporarily elevated during COVID, and now that elevation expires because, you know, the deadline's over. Mm-hmm. But the Republicans have said we might agree to increase that again, but we're not going to do it in exchange for a 6 week extension. It has to be part of a bigger budget bill to come. It's sort of a hopeful promise.
Sure.
And then the other piece of it is these Medicaid cuts were primarily around having to verify whether the people on Medicaid are actually eligible for Medicaid twice a year instead of once a year. and able-bodied people have to work. So now we'll put you in the seat of a United States senator. You're sitting there on either side of the aisle on this. How do you get out of this mess from a – I know you to be a common sense person.
Thank you very
much. Those
are
the two friction points I've just described. You're the prototypical Minnesotan. What would you do?
What would I do?
You can.
Well,
yeah.
What would I do?
What would you do?
Probably start crying first.
Yes.
Blame the opposition. We like to do that.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I don't know how to get out of a mess like this, honestly, because of where we're at politically. No side wants to give in. No side wants to, in any way show what could be construed as weakness. And the minute you give up your position, certainly the Republicans with Trump in the White House, good God, no, there's not going to show weakness. That's part of the Trump playbook, and it has been for, decades. Don't admit defeat. Don't admit you're wrong. Don't apologize. So I don't know how you get this. And certainly the Democrats, want what they believe is something very noble to help Americans with health care. Is that asking too much for, as you said, a 6-week stay? Yeah, it might be. It might be. But if this is the only chance you have because you're looking at Republicans dominating you just as far as the numbers go in the House and controlling the Senate and obviously the White House, I don't know that I fault them for saying, you know what, maybe this is too much, but we don't care. This is our chance to make a stand. And you know what? Who was I listening to? I saw a clip from Joe Scarborough, MSNBC.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Obviously quite a lefty. But he was making the point that throughout recent history, when it comes to government shutdowns, it seems like Republicans are often or always the ones to be blamed. When it happened during Clinton, Clinton skated. People still blame the Republicans. Same with Obama. Even with the Democratic president, America still kind of turned on the Republicans, it seemed, at least in his mind. So if that's your history and you're a Democrat, maybe you roll the dice and hope that's going to happen again just because you see the Republicans are in power throughout.
Well, and negotiations are about leverage. You tell me who's got the leverage in negotiations, and I'll show you who's going to win the negotiation.
Correct, yeah.
And President Trump is now going to say, if you think about what's the leverage, I'm not talking about whether it's right or wrong. I'm just talking about where are the leverage points. If you start threatening the public employee unions with massive layoffs, not just furloughs for which you don't work and get paid back pay later, but actual permanent layoffs, and that begins to roll up large numbers of public employee layoffs, the public employee unions are one of the biggest supporters, both financially and politically, of the Democrats, and that's going to turn up the heat on the Democrats. And so it'll be interesting to see whether he just threatens those layoffs or whether he actually does them, mm-hmm. because it won't be long before the public employee unions are knocking on the door of the Democratic leader saying, okay, we've had enough.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's a very difficult thing, but in the meantime, we have real Americans who need help, who need these services.
Yeah.
And they need to get this thing done, whether, they need to both show their base that they're fighting to the bitter end. But in the meantime, getting to the bitter end costs everyday Minnesotans and everyday Americans inconvenience, worry, problems. And so I hope, regardless of whether our listeners are Republican, Democrat, Independents, nothing or something else, that we can all agree on one way or the other, get the thing settled and resolved, and let's get the country moving again.
Yeah, obviously, that's what everybody wants. A little compromise would be okay.
Yeah, and then, by the way, if they're going to, the Republicans have signaled they are probably willing to keep those Obamacare subsidies elevated for a while longer, extend them anyhow. So if you're going to cough that up, 2 months from now, mm-hmm. why not at least figure how that fits into getting it resolved sooner?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. This is WCCO Radio. You are listening to the Noon to 3 Chad Hartman Show. Tim Pawlenty in for Chad. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk some more Minnesota issues right after this.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, 2-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carman Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Back to the Chad Hartman Show. Tim Pawlenty in for Chad on this beautiful Minnesota fall Friday afternoon. Thank you for being with us. I'm here with super producer Dave Harrigan as we talk a little bit about our Minnesota political scene and some of the things going on in Minnesota, one of which is the incredible Twin Cities Marathon launching this Sunday morning. Dave's run it. I've run it a few times. And it is going to be hot for those runners, and hopefully people will come out and support them. We were just talking during the break about how meaningful it is for the runners to see the kind of support that comes out for people to provide encouragement, a little bit of get up and go encouragement through their words and cheers. It's a really wonderful event, and Minnesota should be proud that it has such a high-quality, well-run marathon.
It's impressive. It really is. I mean, what do they call it? The most beautiful urban marathon in America. It is beautiful, certainly, too warm right now for a whole lot of the leaves to still be changing. But on a normal year, when you're getting some color, when you're running around the Minneapolis Lakes and then up Summit Avenue as you finish towards the Capitol. And it's amazing. At over 26 miles, there's rarely a spot where there's not people cheering.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have their cowbells out. There's Alan Page with the tuba. People have, you know, signs which are encouraging, funny, maybe a little demeaning, but also funny. You know, it's really an impressive event. It is.
And one of my great memories, I was governor. I think I ran it twice when I was governor. But in the event, I was...
How did you have time to train when you were
governor?
I didn't,
and it was painful, David. I mean, I did not go into these marathons in good shape. But I'll just tell two quick stories. I'm in one of them one year, and Sid Hartman, the legendary Sid Hartman, yep, is on me about some stadium issue. I think it was a stadium issue. And so they had the Sunday morning Sid Hartman, Dave Mona sports show here at CCO Radio.
Sports Huddle, absolutely.
Yeah, Sports Huddle. And I'm running the marathon, and it's getting towards the end. So I'm gassed, and we're getting in that part of the marathon, as you and I talk, where towards the end starts to get an uphill.
Going up Summit, that slightly slow climb.
And I've got a scheduled interview while I'm running the marathon with Sid and Dave Mona. And so I'm like dying, trying to sound like not a psychotic weirdo, because I'm starting to leave my body during the marathon, yep, with all the pain and challenge. And then Sid's on me on the radio, or on the phone, barking at me about whatever it was on his mind. So
were you continuing your progress towards the finish during the interview, or did you pull
off? I ran it and did the interview at the same time. But the other thing I did is one year I ran the Twin Cities Marathon in early October, and then I ran the New York Marathon in November, early November. So two marathons, 30 days or so apart. And man, that was brutal. And I wasn't, again, in proper shape for probably either. And I finished it, but I remember at the finish line of the New York City Marathon, the medical team came over, and a couple of people in like the medical vest were pointing at me like,
flag this
like
guy.
This guy right here. But anyhow, congratulations to those who signed up and trained so hard. We wish you well as you run the marathon this Sunday in some hot conditions. And, if you're not a runner, but you're interested or you just want to go out and provide some encouragement to those folks who are running it, it's Sunday morning, and you can get all the information in the local news media. There's a poll, Dave, that came out that you flagged for me this morning. It was a New York Times Siena poll about an overwhelming majority of Americans now believe our political divisions are so bad that we can't come back together politically and maybe as a nation. I don't believe that. I don't doubt the results of that poll, how people feel that. But I am not giving up, and I hope our listeners aren't giving up on the notion that, yes, we have extremes on the right and left, no question about it. But I still believe, A, Americans and Minnesotans are good-hearted, common-sense people. But importantly, 60 or 70% of the people still agree on 60 to 70% of the ideas or the policies. And if that 60 or 70% would show up in caucuses or primaries and vote for more level-headed candidates on the right or the left, the party of their choice or a third party, we'd have better outcomes. But unfortunately, while most people show up and vote in November at the general election, they're outsourcing their voice and their decision-making to very narrow bands of the population when it comes to the parties picking their candidates. And they do that because the primaries in August, for example, have a very small turnout, typically just 10 or 15% of the eligible voters. They tend to be the activists. They tend to be the people who are the most committed, and some people would say most ideologue, either right or left, and we end up with candidates who are sort of reflect that. And then when the country wonders why we're so divided, and I guess a simple solution, if we could get there, would be to say to that 60 to 70% that agrees on 60 to 70% of the stuff, could you please show up and vote earlier in Minnesota's case in the August primary and vote for a candidate that you think might be more level-headed, you know, might be more practical.
I don't see how you get that done.
It never happens.
Yeah, no, it never happens. You know, we can say it every year. Show up for the primary. Show up for the,
and they don't.
And they don't. You know, it's been obviously many, many, many decades that that's been the case. And it's disheartening because I think just as, you know, normal, common sense, fairly middle of the road person, I like to think of myself who probably is part of that 60-70% that you mentioned that can agree on most issues with most people. It's so hard to see how, you know, in my view, and certainly the view of, I think, many, a lot of people want to keep us divided. You know, in a lot of ways, it feels like the media likes to keep us divided because that's what sells. You know, you don't see the, you know, the middle of the road Republicans and Democrats on cable news nearly as much as you see the flamethrowers on both sides, because that draws rating. It's, you know, you, hey, look at this rather genuine person with a common sense argument, or, oh, my gosh, you can't believe what they said about the other side. You know, which are people going to watch? Obviously, we know what the headlines say. It seems like the parties are more than happy to do that, too, because that's what gives them attention.
And I wonder if in a marketplace, and we'll close on this because we got to get to break, but if the 60 to 70% who don't show up in the caucuses or primaries, if they're really saying government to me is sort of irrelevant or not worth my time or attention because, you know, they have other things that they can value or prioritize with what they're doing with their time. And that's one interpretation of it, which is we are not sufficiently concerned, or government is not sufficiently important to me to make that effort.
Or just, I don't feel heard. So why am I going to show up this extra time in August? I'll just maybe show up in November if I'm strong enough, feeling strong enough, either for or against one candidate. But as far as, you know, taking part in the primary process and actually doing the research and actually fighting for my candidate, that's a lot of work.
Well, and one little thing, in Minnesota, at least in April, the dog days of summer, I mean, August, mm-hmm. Could we at least move the primary into a month where Minnesotans aren't enjoy their 90 days of sunshine in the summer? Could we do like many other states and get it into April or you know, March or something? It would also give the candidates more time to campaign to the general election. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk to longtime and well-regarded Twin Cities and Minnesota journalist Rick Capcella, who's the force and the organizational drive behind a documentary that aired last night called Perilous State. And it sort of bundles in 1 hour sort of the challenges facing Minnesota, but particularly Minneapolis. I think you're going to find the discussion very interesting. On WCCO Radio, noon to three with Chad Hartman. We'll be right back with Rick Capcella in his view of Minnesota as a state in peril.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back on the Chad Hartman Show, noon to three. Chad's not here today, but I am Tim Pawlenty, your guest host. And I've mentioned before the break, we have the creator and really the driving force behind a really interesting and I think thought-provoking documentary. It's called A Precarious State. It aired last night for 1 hour. They also have a website called precariousstate.com. And our guest now is Rick Capcella. Most of you will remember him from being on Channel 11, but his career is much deeper and broader than that. And, you know, that by itself was amazing. But he's worked as a journalist both in radio and television across the country in various locations. His work as a journalist has been recognized through Emmy Awards that were given to him and other honors. He's also, by the way, a serial entrepreneur. This is somebody who has envisioned and raised the funds for and started and sold businesses. So in addition to being a journalist, he's got a very extensive early stage and entrepreneurial business background. He's been involved in all sorts of community and nonprofit organizations in Minnesota and elsewhere. And he's also the past president of the Minnesota chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. Rick Capcella, thanks for joining us on WCCO Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you, I know, are busy and you've been all over the media with this documentary, and you and I have talked about it a little bit off air. But take our listeners behind the scenes as to what inspired you to think about this, and what, I know you spent a lot of effort and time and research on this. How did it start, and how did it get to the finish line, which was the airing of the documentary last night?
Yeah, well, it has been a two-year process, which I did not anticipate initially. I thought maybe I'll do a social post, you know. And the more I kept digging on this, it was kind of wild. You know, that whole series of businesses that I was involved in from leaving CARE to the early 20s, we were able to sell several of those, which was awesome. And we had to sadly put one down in the pandemic. And I had a little extra time on my hands, and I got out to see family, went around the country. This is like 23, end of 23. And I hit several cities, and I came back, and it hit me like a brick. You know, I live in Minneapolis, and I've been here for 30 plus years. This is the place I really know and call home. And I knew, you know, we were in a struggle post pandemic, post George Floyd, post rioting. But I didn't really have a full appreciation for the degree to which we were really lagging the nation in coming back in any real meaningful way from that series of challenges we had. It was just that opportunity to see other places and get back here real quick and realize, son of a gun, this is really not improving. And then I started meeting with some friends, business folks. I'd bring them downtown and say, let's just go for a walk through the city, you know, and some of them would call me and do the same and say, let's just go. And I'd say, well, can you just tell me what you see? How do you explain this? And a lot of it was, you know, talking about, this is again, fall, it was a Q4, it was October. So we're right at 2 years in 23. And they're saying, you know, well, this is just, you know, this is what the post-pandemic thing is everywhere in America. And, you know, this is what work from home does to downtowns. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, it's they're not wrong, but they're not right either. I mean, so I would start ribbing them, you know, you travel, don't you? You're still getting out, you're seeing things. And long short, I just started gathering data. And I'd say one of the first pieces of data that I got my hands on that was like, okay, this is way bigger than we think it is, was this Bureau of Labor Statistics data. And they've been doing what I would characterize as a pre versus post pandemic health checkup on major markets around the country. And what they're doing is they're basically asking a simple question to major market areas here. They're looking at the 12 counties around the Twin Cities that are not the Wisconsin counties, they're only Minnesota counties. And they're saying, where are you today relative to where you were in February of 2020 with payroll employment? Okay?
Okay.
It's simple, easy to understand. And they would all report their numbers. And, you know, we have forever been very consistent with our market rank, somewhere around 13, right? We're going to come in nationally. And we're in the bottom. Our payroll employment figures today are net negative still from where they were in February of 2020. Meanwhile, you know, so we're ranking anywhere from 42 to 48 out of 49 over the last 2 years. And that puts us in a net negative zone that mostly has been between negative 20,000 jobs and negative 36,000 jobs. Okay? The only market in America performing worse most of the time this year has been San Francisco, economically like this. And that data, meanwhile, the top of that list, you know, is, well, San Antonio. It isn't a red state, but it's in a blue city. It is a blue city. And Austin, I'm sorry, this is a state capital, Austin. And Austin has added 225,000 jobs in the time that we have continued to be net negative for so long. And the top 14 markets in the country have all added way over 100,000 new jobs. So it was this relativism. So it's one thing to look at the relativism as it relates just to ourselves. How did we used to be? Where are we today? But where are we as it relates to the rest of the country has been saddening, frankly. And the whole effort here has been to get at root causes and what are challenges we're facing and what has to be true to turn things around.
I'm talking to, we're listening to Rick Pacella. He is the driving force behind a documentary called A Precarious State, focused on some of the challenges facing Minnesota. It aired last night. It's available at precariousstate.com. Rick, I watched it again this morning, and you know, you go through in the documentary, and your team does, a number of categories. You go through job data. You go through population out-migration, in-migration. You go through the decline of educational test scores. You go through a number of other sort of business startup measures, both statistically and impressionistically, like sort of the downfall of Uptown Minneapolis. But at the end of the day, it's sort of, and I know it's a state measurement, but you're really significantly focused on Minneapolis. At the end of the documentary, you sort of come to some conclusions about why Minnesota, even factoring in COVID, is in relative terms, relative to other similar places, lagging. And in what kinds of conclusions did you reach, and what kind of hope can you give us about how it could get better?
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest changes since the pandemic, particularly in the cities, and this is true for both cities, but it's particularly true for Minneapolis, is that there has been the immediate kind of knee-jerk reaction on the backside of what happened with George Floyd was to run after a concept of defunding the police. We don't need this. We can do this with unarmed violence interrupters. We can be, you know, we'll be just fine without the police. That was a movement that has been and still underway. There was a public vote. The public said, don't do that. But the city council has actually continued to, they still have the power of the purse, right? The city council does for the city. And despite the, you know, their big effort to, hey, let's get an all out kumbaya from the community that they'll vote for defunding police, the city said, city people said no. But then what they did was they just turned to this other device they have, which is just controlling the budgets as the city council. And they've continued to just pull 100,000 from here and a million from over there. And they've been doing this all along. And it has put us in a place where crime has become a significant challenge. It's been worse since during the pandemic. But it's been, it's moderating a little. But still, I mean, homicides are up, you know, almost 50% over where they were in 2019 for where we are in the year. And it really, I'd say one of the great challenges we have is the influence of the Democratic socialist agenda on the city council in the city of Minneapolis. Now, maybe the public really wants this. Maybe they know that this is what they have and they voted for this and they want this, which would be really important, I think, for all of the rest of us to know, you know, that this is that this is what our city by majority wants to see happen, because it's a very different world from our Democratic approach that we've had for so long in the city. Democratic socialists and democratic farm labor are two very different things. And our research has indicated that the public really has very little understanding of these two very different organizations taking the name Democrat on the city council and driving this agenda, this ideology that really... It's incredible when you really understand what the ideology is and what they are trying to get done as an organization nationally. So the hope is that, you know, people will pay attention to what's happening, that they will associate specific actions with specific outcomes, and that they'll take the action and make the decisions that would bring about the best outcomes. Like I say, maybe that will happen. Maybe, I don't know. This is the big thing I don't know, after 2 years even, is what does this community really want, right? What do they really want? And I think we're going to find out here, you know, even this year is a big year. That city council will be up for election, 100% of them, due to the redistricting, you know, timelines. This is an unusual time that it'll be 100% of the city council re-voted on all at once. But I just don't. I don't know what the public's going to do. Do you?
Well, I don't. I have hopes in that regard, and I want to make it clear, Rick. You have made it clear to me, both in public settings and private settings, you're not electioneering. You just started with a concern, and you looked at what you believe to be facts and statistics, and presented them to create a measurement. Again, even factoring in COVID and George Floyd. Of that Minnesota's lagging, and then you sort of trace that back to policy decisions. So I want to be clear on your behalf that, you know, you're not presenting this as some sort of electioneering platform. You're just saying this is what the data revealed, and it seems to coincide with certain policy decisions, especially in Minneapolis. Is that a fair summary?
That is very fair.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a short break on WCCO Radio. We're talking to Rip Capcella, the driving force, really the main engine behind this very, very thought-provoking documentary called The Precarious State. Again, precariousstate.com is the website. If you want to watch it, it's available there, as well as some other materials regarding the documentary. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk more with Rick about that very topic. Welcome back to the Chad Hartman Show, guest hosted today by me, Tim Pawlenty. And it's time for Linda's Construction Time Check. And with Linda's Construction, you can give your home a new look with 50% off installation, both labor and siding, through October 31st, and the time is 12:50. Say, on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline, we have Rick Capcella, the driving force behind the documentary A Precarious State. We were talking before the break about the statistical measurements of how Minnesota, specifically the Twin Cities especially, and even more specifically Minneapolis, is lagging, even compared to other cities. Even after COVID. And Rick, we were talking about what's a way out of this or what's a way to improve it. And I did hear an interview with George Will lately, or not too long ago, where he said he hopes that Mondami wins in New York. This is the Democrat socialist candidate for mayor, because we need, in his view, isolated examples of how socialism is doomed to fail. And by containing it to a city level experiment, the rest of the country can see how naive and idiotic it turns out to be. And, you know, for Minnesota to go down that route, we can't really afford to have our major cities, you know, go down the toilet as an experiment while we all watch to learn for the future day. So I think we have to be more constructive than that. And I know the documentary didn't focus too much on St. Paul, but, you know, when there's not a wild game or one of the baseball games going or a concert over there, and they got just a couple headquarters left, you know, that can be a pretty sad environment there as well. So my hope is that the public will, you know, through their voice, through the elections, will make choices that will result in a better way forward as it relates to policing, as it relates to, a safe environment for people to feel like they can invest and move around and enjoy our cities. And by the way, we've made massive private and public investment in these major cities. Just letting them go down the toilet is not a good plan. So, So I'm hopeful in that people will wake up to these facts. I think your documentary moves the ball so significantly in that regard. But I want to ask you, as you went through this over 2 years, what surprised you the most? I mean, what finding, besides the net job loss statistics you were citing earlier, was there something else that kind of surprised you that you didn't think too much about ahead of time?
I think at the end of the day, what the best way to answer that, it was the collection of things. You know, it's not a discrete problem over here or one over there. You know, these are like fundamental functions of government, really, and society more broadly. But when you look at things like public safety, the economy, these buildings that, you know, we have the highest distress rate in America. We had it in the report last night at 49.7% distressed. Well, I'll be doggone if in the few weeks between, you know, when that got edited in and when it got broadcast, it had gone up to 56.7% is where it is right now. And the nearest number two is 12 points behind, okay, among major markets. And what that distress rate means is that they're facing bankruptcy or they're unable to get new financing having trouble getting new financing for their loans to keep the buildings. And when you see things like the Ameriprise going down for like 3 cents on the dollar it sold, you look at those kind of major economic moves, you look at the education outcomes where our students are being surpassed by Mississippi and Louisiana in reading scores. It's breathtaking, the scope. And, and then you add just, like I say, police safety to the middle of that, and you have the kind of crime situation we have dealing with. So it's this collection of things that, I was really just perplexed initially. I mean, how many, disparate things could actually be going on at the same time that were that kind of magnitude different? We've been on the opposite end of that. We had the least vacancy in America pre-pandemic. Okay. So and now among the highest. That's the collection. I mean, it's the totality that I found just almost overwhelming.
Yeah, and I know it's a lot for our listeners to consume all at once in terms of the number of things that you flagged in the documentary, but I guess in the short time we have left, Rick, I would flag two that I think are perhaps most important. One is the thing that you've just addressed, public safety. I mean, people cannot have prosperity or security without, they won't invest, they won't dream, they won't take big risks unless they feel safe. They won't even come downtown unless they feel safe with the perception of safety. And the police force is arguably half the size it should be. And, of course, they've got other challenges as well. And I think you cannot have a Lord of the Flies situation where we're going to police ourselves, because human nature is such that it turns very challenging very quickly. And, this idea that, defund the police was a good idea. I think it was one of the most devastatingly bad ideas in modern political history. So I think restoring the police departments and making sure we have a safe environment is one. And the second thing I would quickly flag is that educational issue. I mean, we have not even 50% of our students in Minnesota proficient in reading or math at grade level. And you can't have a future where if you can't have the skills or the education necessary to access the private economy, you're in a world of hurt. And then things go very badly for you and your family. And so we have to get Minnesota back to, regardless of anybody's politics, we have to agree that having half of our kids not being able to read and do math at grade level is a preposterous place for Minnesota to be. And I think those are fixable, bipartisan things that most people would agree to.
I aspire to your level of articulation on these things. I'm still getting there.
Oh, no, you are there. But, well, we appreciate you. I know you came on, you were trying to get out of town for another thing, so we want to be respectful of your time. But I really encourage our listeners, regardless of your political view, to at least look at this. I think it presents really helpful information from a data and statistics standpoint. Again, it's A Precarious State. And did I have the website right, Rick? Is it precariousstate.com?
That is right.
Okay.
That is correct.
Anything else you want to say in closing, or did we cover it well enough?
No, I think you've really covered it. I really do appreciate it. And I would just hope that each of us can kind of look at what is our responsibility in trying to better our environment, and to think through those things and to act on those things in ways that can help lift up the community, because at the end of the day, it's about the people, and we need all of us to get it right.
Well, well said. Well said. Enjoy your Minnesota weekend, and enjoy your time finally getting this documentary done, and we appreciate you being on WCCO Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to have another guest that I think you're going to enjoy, and that is Rochelle Olson, who is with the Star Tribune, and she has Cheers and Jeers and other insights regarding the Minnesota landscape politically and otherwise. So hope you'll continue to listen. We'll be right back after this.
not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a great conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.